Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, Dr. Jamie Kaufman says we're in the midst of an epidemic. She's talking about something that affects over 125 million Americans, and that is acid reflux. But have you heard of silent reflux? Well, Dr. Kaufman is the leading expert on this in the world. She really is one of the pioneers around this topic. And she's shedding light on the silent killer. She did a great segment on the Dr. Oz show just last week. And will join us later in today's show to share why it's important that we identify if we have silent reflux and what we can do about it. It is fairly curable and very treatable, so that's the good news. Also in today's show, have you ever become an accidental manager? Well, it's happening to more and more people with downsizing of companies, reorganizations, and rewriting of job descriptions. And not everybody's happy about it. So as many as 75% of managers really don't want to be managers, according to senior leadership and connection consultant Deborah Zack. She'll join us later to share how to be successful by simply being ourselves. She says one size definitely does not fit all, and she's going to give us some tips on how we can cope with that. We're trying to get hold of our first guest right now. She was supposed to have joined us, called us about 10 minutes ago, so she's a little MIA right now, but we're going to take a very quick break and try a different number, and we'll be back either way in just a couple of minutes.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Conversations Live has a new Facebook page, and we'd love you to join us there. Click on Like to join our page, and you can share a link to your business or event, or share a few words about yourself and what's happening in your world. You can even recommend future guests or topics. We're easy to find. Just search for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair Facebook, log in, and leave a post. Look forward to meeting you there.
Hi, I'm Pat Pauly, and I hope you listen to my brand new radio show, Get Active, at 12:30 in the afternoon each Tuesday for ideas on how you can stay fit and active and connected to our community. Each week, we'll have a guest who knows in depth about some activity you may be interested in. We'll cover everything from working out, sports, sailing, skiing, to bridge, dancing, volunteering, you name it. Again, it's Get Active at 12:30 in the afternoon each Tuesday, right here at Alternative Talk 1150.
Who is Jopra?
What is Jopra?
When is Jopra?
Joe Janot is the host of a brand new show called Jopra. Joe has been nicknamed Jopra by his friends and colleagues who find his advice and insight to be enlightening, just like a certain other talk show host of world renown. Born and raised in Seattle, independent-minded Joe Janot is bringing issues to the airwaves that make you ponder, laugh, and deliberate. The Jopra Show is about the ins and outs of food and drink, relationships, entertainment, and so much more. Get to know Jopra every Thursday at 2, right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Alternative to what? Alternative to everything else out there on the radio. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and I'm pleased to say we did manage to connect with Anna White. She is an amazing woman. She has built this great empire literally around her passion. I mean, literally around her passion. Anna White describes herself as a mother and homemaker from Alaska. She's the blogger behind the scenes at Anna-White, Anna-White.com. She's an avid self-taught do-it-yourself expert, and she's designed thousands of furniture projects that are attractive, unique, and budget-friendly. She's the author of a fabulous new book. It's called The Hand-Built Home. Anna White, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here today.
And I'm pleased to have you here. First of all, your site is fantastic. Boy, what a way to lose a few hours looking around there. So I understand you've always had a passion for building and creating, and you especially like working with wood. Tell us what your childhood was like and how you came to be passionate about that.
Well, I think we all have something in us that makes us a little special, right? And when I was a little girl, the other girls would be playing with dolls and doing that sort of thing, and I would be out finding old 2x4s and pounding the nails out and making forts in the woods. So I think just me personally, I've always had a passion and kind of a natural inclination to love to build. But I also think that many people love to build. You know, think of kids playing with Legos or kids playing with Lincoln Logs. I think building is just fun for everybody. But for me especially, I certainly had a great passion for it all along.
So I read that you, even though you like to build, you like to create, you're always afraid of power tools. And you said tongue in cheek on your, at least I hope it was tongue in cheek, on your blog. It's no accident that you married the first man that was building something on your first date. He's called Ram, a real Alaska man.
Yes. You know, when I grew up, my brothers were taught how to use power tools. They were expected to, and I was not taught. I was expected to not know how to use power tools. I was always told they were too difficult and that I could hurt myself and, you know, things like that. And really, a drill isn't about being stronger or tougher. It's just about having a little bit of education experience to know how to properly use it and to use it safely. The same with most power tools. So, yes, I never learned how to use power tools as a child. I didn't learn until my mid-20s. And up until then, I would ask somebody to cut boards for me or to screw this together. And it was my husband for the longest time. I would beg him when he got home from work to please cut these boards and use the nailer because I was scared.
Right.
And at some point, though, I realized, you know, this is my passion. My husband doesn't want to work all day and then come home and build things for me. I'm the one that wants this. And 94% of all furniture buying decisions is made by women, yet we're making the men build our furniture. It would be like the men sewing our quilts. You know, we're the one that wants this, so I really felt like it was time for me to just kind of take matters into my own hands and figure out how to build my own furniture.
Right. And I mean, how many times have you heard women complain that, oh, yes, well, this was designed by a man. That's why it's not working for us as a woman.
Yes, that is so true. Absolutely. Because if you're asking somebody else to make something, it's not going to be what you specifically want. So like the term do-it-yourself, I love it because you are in control of what you're making. You call all the shots. You're the boss of your project, mm-hmm. not your husband, not the store you bought it for from. You are. And, you know, so definitely I highly encourage all women out there to figure out how to use a drill. It's nothing different than a hand mixer. If you can make frosting, if you can beat eggs, you can use the drill. It's the same thing.
Right. Now, your passion, I mean, it turned into this blog, first of all. You're now getting, I read, over 1 million unique visitors a month, over 3 million page hits a month. How did you start building your blog? Why did you start writing a blog?
Well, I had this great passion for building furniture, and it was like an obsession for me, and I loved it, and I loved to share it. And I loved coming up with new designs. And I really wanted to take it to the next level to possibly a book or a magazine, but I just lacked the confidence, didn't have the experience, didn't know anybody. So I had no network, no support system. Really, there was no possible way for me, this mom in remote Alaska with no education or experience, to possibly pursue a dreams of taking their passion and into a book or a magazine or, you know, other medium. So when I first discovered blogging through reading a friend's personal blog, I thought, hey, I could get one of these, and I could post plans on it. And after 20 years, when my daughter is in college and my husband retires, maybe I could write a publisher and say, look, I have this blog. Would you consider looking at it and possibly thinking about publishing a plan in your magazine?
Well, you have a great... the back of the book. The book is terrific, by the way. I mean, I love this because for anybody who is inspired to create their own stuff, you've looked at budgets. So you indicate whether it's under $50, $100, or over $100 to make it. And you've got these icons which indicate that throughout the book. And you say at the back of the book that it's almost selfish for a mother to have a dream of her own, but I always disagree with that, because I think you're teaching your children, your daughters especially, that it's okay to have a dream and it's okay to have interests outside the family.
Absolutely. I can see that now, but with the newborn baby crying and dinner to cook and dishes and, you know, bills that we're barely paying, and it just, for mom to say, look, by the way, on top of all these things that we've got going on, I want to follow my dreams too.
Right.
I think that it's just too much to ask a family.
Right.
Especially when you've got young children. And I totally agree with you that if mom isn't happy, nobody's happy. But at the same time, it's like when there's so many more urgent and pressing things that consume your time and your money.
Yeah.
My dreams were really put on the back burner.
Sure, and I totally understand that. I mean, it is something that everybody has to balance. You know, the other thing I like is I like the icon key. I started talking about that in the book because it tells you how much time it's going to take you to make this. And it's inspired all kinds of ideas for me, because there are certain things that I can't find in the store that I really want. And I have a vision in my head. And it's inspired me to start thinking about making my own. When you talk to people, what are their most common reactions? What are their most common questions to you, Anna?
You know, when I first start talking to somebody, they kind of don't believe that I'm really the one making the furniture. They usually tend to look at my husband and say, okay, what's the real inside scoop? Do you make it? And my husband is definitely capable of making all of the furniture, but he will tell them, look, it's my wife's thing. It's her passion. It's her interest, and I proudly support her in that. And then the next question is, you know, but you need all these tools. And the truth is, you don't need a lot of tools. You can make most of the furniture in the book with a drill, asking your hardware store to cut your boards for you. And then I usually get somebody saying, well, I'm scared to try because I don't want to mess it up. And I actually think furniture is a really great spot to start if you're thinking of improving your home, because it's an independent object. So if you go and you decide you're going to add some sort of molding treatment to your walls, and you mess it up, you're stuck taking it down off your wall and repairing your wall. If you start a small project that costs you $3 to make and you make a mistake, you know, it's not the end of the world. It's not a big deal to fix it. It's not a big deal to, you know, move on to the next project.
Right, right.
And, yeah, so it's definitely a great thing to build a lot of confidence to start on a small independent furniture project where you can make some mistakes. And the other thing I tell people is, you would never expect to go into the kitchen for the first time and make a 5-star gourmet meal. You should definitely expect to learn as you go, to start small and work your way up and build not just projects, but build your confidence as a builder.
Yeah. One of the things, one of your favorite rooms you say is the arts and crafts room, office and crafts room. And I know people who've complained they can't just find the right project table, and you've got some great ideas in here for that. And I love the colors in here. We don't have to be stuck with black or white or brown.
No, you're the boss of your project. So if you want to paint it pink, blue, white, you know, that's all up to you. And I'm so glad you like the project table. I love the idea of incorporating more storage, but still having all the functionality of a table.
Yeah, on your daybed too, because I'm actually in the market for a daybed. And I looked at this and I thought, well, geez, this looks pretty easy to build. And look at all the storage I'd have too, because it's one of the things that put me off buying it. They take up so much room with no storage.
Right. There's a ton of storage in that daybed. I mean, it's on two sides. And the really cool thing about the daybed is it's actually finished on all four sides. So you could, you know, put it in the as a, it looked like a couch with three sides exposed.
Right.
And it would look great. So,
right.
Yeah, definitely a great project to add a lot of storage. And the really cool thing about all the plans in the book, and I highly encourage people to do this, is look at my plans as like a recipe book and make the recipes your own. So if you want to, you know, add a little height to the daybed, you want to just do storage on one side because the back side's against the wall, that sort of thing, you can do all of those things. That's the great thing about DIY, is not just are you saving a ton of money, you're getting exactly what you want.
Right, right. Well, I have to say the site is great. It's if you're interested in this kind of thing, I mean, you could very well while away a good afternoon looking at some of the ideas. I love the fact that in the book you've also incorporated other ideas. They're all by women, all young women. With one woman I read had five children.
Yes.
One woman has moved 11 times with her husband in the military. They all build their own furniture and create their own projects. There are 34 simple, stylish, and budget-friendly projects for every room in your book, The Hand-Built Home. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Anna?
Just that you can do it. You will surprise yourself by how capable you are. And if I, somebody with not a huge amount of experience in woodworking or power tools, can do this, I truly believe anybody out there mm-hmm. has the ability to improve their home, no matter what their budget is, and get exactly what they want.
Right. And I'm asked this question all the time by people. How do I make my blog successful? What do you accredit the success of your blog to?
Just trying to be extremely valuable to your readers and looking at your readers as, you know, I call myself a servant to my readers.
Right.
What can I do for you? And really respecting your readers and being thankful for them.
All right. Good advice. I thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Anna's book, it's Anna with one N, Anna-White.com. You can find her site there. And her new book is called The Hand-Built Home. And it really is an inspiring book if you're tempted to build your own stuff, save some money, and get some really unique projects, furniture ideas. Do stay with us. We'll come back. When we come back, we're going to talk about The Accidental Manager. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Charlize Theron with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Almost all the puppies for sale at your local mall were churned out by breeding facilities called puppy mills.
Constant confinement drives the dogs mad. They are impregnated continually until they can no longer produce a litter.
If you choose a dog from the mall, a dog you could have saved from the pound will die.
Contact PETA to learn how you can make a difference at 757-622-PETA. Or visit PETA.org.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Embracing change is the top survival skill, and resilience today is more important than ever before. Coming Monday, October 29th, on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Patty Dobrowolski, comic actor, high-performance business consultant, and TEDx speaker who specializes in helping to actualize the transformations we desire through a dream-to-reality mapping process. Join us for a fun and inspiring experience at noon Pacific on Monday, October 29th. And if you have a dream-to-reality transformation question, a big challenge, or a great success story you'd like to share, email Vicki at info@conversationslive.net.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Proud to bring variety to your radio dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Well, have you ever become an accidental manager? It seems to be happening to more and more people, with companies reorganizing, downsizing, rewriting job descriptions, and not everybody's happy about it. In fact, my guest says that 75% of managers really don't care to be managers. Devorah Zak is the CEO of Only Connect Consulting, and she's an expert speaker, strategy consultant, author, and executive coach. She served as a visiting faculty member of Cornell University's Johnson Graduate School of Management's Leadership Skills Program for 15 years, where she taught MBA students from across the world. She's a certified practitioner in the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator and Neuro-Linguistic Programming. And she's also had a few other interesting journeys along the way, which we'll talk about in just a moment. Devorah Zak, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks.
And I want to let listeners know that your new book is called Managing for People Who Hate Managing. Be a success by being yourself. I love this. You have a picture of an elephant standing on a ball, trying to balance his leg on a ball here. And I think this is how a lot of people feel these days. Their jobs have been kind of thrown up in the air, and people are having to re-interview for their existing jobs. They're having to take on additional responsibilities. They're having to become managers when they've never had any real desire to become a manager, or they've never had any training to be a manager. Is that a true number, that 75% of people really don't like, want to be managers?
That's very accurate. There have been many studies on the topic, and that is about the average 25%, sometimes less.
Wow.
And only 10% of people state that they've had any kind of training whatsoever to be managers when they are, in fact, managers.
That explains it all.
That explains a big part of it.
It does, doesn't it? So you wrote this book for those people, right?
That's correct. I did. And the other thing that explains it is that most people's aspiration is not to become a manager. Most people are very good at and enjoy their technical skills and excel at the field they're in. And as a reward, congratulations, they become a manager, which is something they didn't want and weren't pursuing to start with. And in fact, career success is measured by being promoted to management. And most of us aren't good at it, never wanted it, and feel like we have to be fake to be successful managers, which is not the truth, in fact.
Well, there's an old saying out there, if you want to ruin a good salesman, make him a manager.
That's a good thing. It's true in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
Not every case, but most.
Yeah. So what is the most common struggle that people have when they first become a manager? I can remember mine was probably, I kind of grew up in management because I worked in my parents' businesses. But when I first moved to America, I was in a whole different culture, a whole different country. And, you know, nobody could understand my accent. and after a couple of weeks, it was making me lose my confidence. But what do most people suffer with when they first become managers?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of us are taught by well-meaning authors and consultants and speakers that to be a good manager, there are certain rules you have to follow. There's the 5 rules of success, the 10 laws of management, and that is just not accurate. And the truth is that the only way, the only one rule to being a manager is to know who you are and to work with your own natural strength. And it's not that you have to be like someone else or take on characteristics that don't suit you, which is what most people think. I have to be a manager by being somebody else.
Right.
The only way to be successful is by working with, instead of fighting against, your natural personality style. So that's really the bottom line of being a good manager. And that's the reason why most people feel they aren't good managers. They think they have a sense they have to be fake to be successful.
Right. And if people really thought about it logically, the reason they were probably promoted to manager in the first place is because they were doing a good job as themselves.
That's a very good point.
So let's first of all diss the golden rule, as you call it. Dr. Stephen Covey said many years ago, don't treat others as you want to be treated, treat them as they want to be treated. And I think when you realize this as a manager, it makes a huge difference.
Exactly right. I call that the platinum rule, treat others how they want to be treated. And the way to do that is a technique that I call flexing your style. And flexing your style means that while being true to yourself, to meet other people while where they are at. So I need to work for my strength and be authentic, and at the same time be flexible in how I communicate and how I motivate and how I mentor other people. And being flexible means speaking the language that people can understand and modifying the way I motivate people to match their own temperaments, not my temperament.
Right. And talking of flexing your style, I mean, I just want to share this with our listeners. You've also worked as an investigative reporter, emergency counselor, actress, disc jockey, and a disc jockey in the U.S. and Italy. So you've certainly flexed your style along the way. What's the biggest challenge to people when they're trying to flex their style?
The biggest challenge is that most of us are interacting with people of a whole bunch of different personality styles. So it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort, and you really need to focus on people to pick up on the cues that they're bombarding us with about how they want to be treated and what excites them and what turns them off. So the biggest challenge is that most of us are distracted. Most of us aren't focused on other people. We miss about 95% of the cues people are sending us because we're thinking about other things. We're thinking about ourselves. We're thinking about what we want to say. We're thinking about what just happened or what's about to happen. So what I highly encourage managers to do is to really focus on the people in front of them, whether they're supervisees, their peers, their coworkers, or even their own managers. And once you really focus on people, you'll catch on to the types of things they care about, what their temperament is, how they are motivated, and you'll really be much, much more effective when you're working with them.
Right, and you stress in the book these are the two skills you need to have, the aptitude to assess others' temperaments and the ability to modify our communication style on the fly. You know, I used to train a lot of managers, and they would, one of the things I'd hear constantly was, why do I have to adapt my style to suit that employee? Answer that for us, if you would.
I'm so glad you asked. The answer is because most people aren't that skilled. So, and an even bigger question we'll ask is, why would I have to modify myself to manage my own manager even?
Right,
and,
right.
So there's really two questions behind that. One is, why do I have to do it? The second is, why don't they change to meet me where I'm at? So the first thing is, other people aren't that skilled. So you have to always assume you're the one that has to make the effort, because most people aren't that good at communicating. Most of us are much better at communicating than what we think, and there have been studies that prove that as well. And the other reason why is because And this question comes a lot from people that are more pragmatic and pragmatic. They think, why do we care about people's feelings? Like, people should just do their work. Why do I have to go to all this effort to make them motivated? And when you are able to encourage people and to propel them to be more successful, you're going to have higher productivity, better outcomes, more effectiveness, stronger teamwork. So the results are very, very strong. So on one level, the reason is because they aren't capable of doing it, and so you may as well be capable of doing it. And the second reason is because it pays off a lot of dividends, a lot of pragmatic, practical, bottom-line dividends to modify your communication style. It's not a soft skill. It results in bottom-line impact.
Yeah. Yeah, you say that a lot of average to middling managers, they just think they're too busy to bother with this stuff, and it really is key.
That's right. They're too busy to not bother with it. The average manager spends about 7 hours a week sorting out personality conflicts, for instance. Mm. That's a lot of wasted time. If you are working proactively to focus on adapting your style to make people more effective, you'll be saving 7 hours a week
right.
in not sorting out personality conflicts.
Right. A couple of things that you also dispel here that I have to agree with. One popular management technique you say spells misery for introverts, or for anybody actually, ultimately, if you've got to get work done, is an open door policy. So you recommend having an open door policy, but doing what with it?
That's right. So, well, it's really a shift on open door policies is having sign-up sheets. It's really simple. It's saying, here's when you can interrupt me, and let's plan in advance when you can interrupt me. People think, oh, to be a great manager, I need to be accessible all the time. And actually, the reverse is true. Most of us are more effective when we're not interrupted constantly. And secondly, if I'm saying my door's open to you all the time, that means if another person reports to me in my office, you can come in and interrupt them. And that is not effective for either one of you.
Right.
So to be successful and to be more effective for yourself and to show that you really care about your employees, the answer is not to have an open door policy, but to say, when I'm with you, I'm with you, and nobody else can interrupt me.
Right, right. I remember working with a freelancer not very long ago, and it's like every single thought that popped in her head, she'd send me an email. So I end up with about 22. One day I had 22 emails just of this one person, and I said, you know what I want you to do is every time you have a thought, write it down and send it in one email.
Good for you.
If you can't figure it out yourself before then.
That's right.
You also, what was the other question I wanted to ask you? I want to talk about networking, that was it, because you've also written a great book called Networking for People Who Hate Networking. And networking is a key component of being a manager. And, you know, when people are new managers or not, you know, coping with it, they're feeling frazzled, networking is just one more thing adding to that list. Give us a couple of maybe your top two tips on networking for people who hate networking.
Yeah, it's another one of my favorite topics. And it's one of my favorite topics only because I myself hate networking. So the first tip I would say in terms of networking is to network in a way that suits your natural style. So less is more. And that, again, flies in the face of most conventional networking advice. Most people say get out there as much as possible, meet as many people as possible, have constant contact. I say the exact opposite. It's quality, not quantity. Go to fewer events, meet fewer people, make more meaningful, lasting, deeper, mutually beneficial connections. Real networking is about making meaningful, deep connections, not about meeting a whole bunch of people and collecting a whole bunch of cards. So that's my first tip. The second tip is if you're not following up, you're not networking. The most important aspect of networking is not what happens at the event that night, but what happens the next day to follow up. Many of us think we're good networkers because we can work a room. All that means is that you can talk to strangers. It does not mean you're a good networker. You're a good networker if you can turn a conversation into a meaningful, mutually beneficial connection, and that only happens through meaningful follow-up.
Absolutely. A waste of time doing it otherwise, right?
Absolutely.
So let's talk about the powers of positive reinforcement, because this is one of the best books I've ever read. And I'm going back like 20 years, I think, when I read this was by Richard LaBeouf. It's called the GMP Principle, the greatest management principle ever. It's a tiny, tiny little book, but it's all about positive reinforcement and how we often reward bad behavior inadvertently. And I think that's particularly true if you're a new manager. You can think you're responding to situations, but you're really paying attention and rewarding bad behavior. So share your story on positive reinforcement, the powers of positive reinforcement, if you would.
That's a really good point. When I'm leading seminars and doing keynotes, sometimes I ask people, how do you know if you've done something wrong? And people are very, very quick to respond. They say, because somebody tells me I messed up. And then I say, how do you know if you're doing something right? And the room goes silent. And what they're really saying and what they eventually say is that nobody tells me if I'm doing something right. And so, unfortunately, most people focus if we're doing something wrong rather than doing something right. If we tell people when they're doing something right, we are much more effective at propelling them into not only positive outcomes but stronger results than if we tell them we're doing something wrong. And if people who are quality managers, top managers, there was a recent study by the National Bureau of Economic Research in the U.S. that they can actually increase employee output by 1.3 units per day.
Mm-hmm.
So people are about a third more productive when we are positive managers who let them know when they're doing something right.
Right, right. Lots been written about sociopaths lately. There have been a lot of books out, and you have a little segment in here about sociopaths in you, because you say you will run into them. They say one in 25 people is a sociopath. How do we need to treat them differently, Devorah?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because many people have a misunderstanding that sociopaths are only serial killers or people you read about in the news. But most sociopaths are people who are out there in the workforce just like us, and they seem really normal, and actually they seem better than normal. They seem charming and charismatic more often than not. And what happens is they're able to turn things around and make you think there's something wrong with you, and then it slowly evolves into them really wreaking havoc in an organization. So on the one hand, in 24 out of 25 cases, which is the vast majority of people, we are able to motivate them and propel them to be successful by being great managers. In 1 out of 25 people, no matter what we do, they'll only drain us, undermine us, and really cause problems for us in the organization. So at a certain point, you need to be able to say, look, this person is not manageable, and you need to be able to document what's going wrong and to let that person go, and to not overthink it and think, oh, I need to try harder. At a certain point, some people are actually toxic for the work environment, and those are sociopaths.
Yeah, and you learn that as you go along being the manager. There are some people you just can't fix, some situations you can't fix, so you've got to take the next best step, right?
That's right. And cognitive dissonance really comes in, because these people always, always start off at being charming and wonderful. And so we stick with that initial impression of them, and we don't want to let go of it, and we don't want to think that we messed up by thinking they were great to start with. And just to keep in mind, everybody falls for sociopaths at one point in their life, and you're not unique in that, and to not beat up on yourself, and just to cut your losses.
Yeah. Well, a fun book, Managing for People Who Hate Managing, but you've got some great tips in here. Be a success by being yourself. I also enjoyed your haiku in there.
Thank you so much. I'm glad you appreciate it.
and my guest here, Devorah Zack, you can find out more about Devorah and her work and her books. Remember, the networking book, too, Networking for People Who Hate Networking. You can find out more about her at her website, myonlyconnect.com. Thanks so much for being with us, Devorah.
Thanks for having me.
And please do stay with us. When we come back, we're going to talk about something that affects over 125 million people in America with one of the world's leading experts on this subject. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Women worldwide see beauty in their mothers, sisters, daughters, and friends. However, only 4% of those women see the same beauty in themselves. Hi, I'm Lisa Ling, and I've traveled the world for years and have witnessed firsthand the devastating effects of low self-esteem among women. We should all pledge to inspire the next generation to see their beauty as a source of confidence, not anxiety.
This message was brought to you by the Alliance for Women in Media and was made possible through the generous support of the Dove Movement for Self-Esteem. To learn more, visit DoveMovement.com.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Embracing change is the top survival skill, and resilience today is more important than ever before. Coming Monday, October 29th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Patty Dobrowolski, comic actor, high-performance business consultant, and TEDx speaker who specializes in helping to actualize the transformations we desire through a dream-to-reality mapping process. Join us for a fun and inspiring experience at noon Pacific on Monday, October 29th. And if you have a dream-to-reality transformation question, a big challenge, or a great success story you'd like to share, email Vicky at info@conversationslive.net.
Get current weather, traffic, and news. Visit 1150kknw.com and stay informed with Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we're switching gears in this segment. We're talking with Dr. Jamie Kaufman. She says we're in the midst of an epidemic. She's talking today about something that affects 125 million people. And something that is often not really fully understand. Dr. Jamie Kaufman is one of the world's leading authorities on reflux. She's lectured widely on that subject around the globe. For nearly three decades, her pioneering research has focused on reflux as it affects the voice and breathing passages. Dr. Kaufman is the founder and director of the Voice Institute of New York, one of the premier voice treatment centers in the U.S., and she's professor of clinical otolaryngology at New York Medical College. She's been listed as one of America's top doctors every year for the past 18 years. She just opened the Kaufman Reflux Center in New York City, and she's got a brand new book out called Dropping Acid, the Reflux Diet Cookbook and Cure. Dr. Jamie Kaufman, welcome to the show today.
Thank you very much, Vicky. A pleasure.
Well, I made a point of catching you on Dr. Oz last week because I thought this was such an important subject because it is so often misdiagnosed. It's often misunderstood. According to what I've read, reflux has become one of the most widespread and yet potentially preventable diseases of Western civilization. As many as 40% of Americans suffer from reflux at some level. So tell us, in your terms, what acid reflux is. And then,
well, reflux literally comes from words in Latin that mean backflow. So reflux means backflow. And a lot of things backflow. You can have reflux in your toilet. You can have reflux coming up from your stomach. Reflux is a generic term for backflow. And when stomach contents, especially the acid and digestive enzymes, backflow into the esophagus, it can produce damage there. And indeed, a cancer of the esophagus, which is reflux caused, is the fastest growing cancer in the United States. So reflux is a big problem. I got into this because my area of interest is the voice, the throat, and the airway. And what we found out over the course of the last decade is a surprise. For example, many people who have reflux present with asthma, but they don't really have asthma. It just seems like asthma. Many people with reflux have sinus problems. Some of them have even had sinus surgery. Many people with voice problems have reflux. They wake up in the morning with a whiskey voice. That's fine unless you're a singer or a radio person. So we found that literally 18% of the American population, including a large number of people under age 30, have what we call silent reflux. And so the clincher for that silent reflux diagnosis is that people don't have heartburn or typical symptoms that tell them that acid is coming up.
So we could be like just find ourselves clearing our throat a lot. We might feel as though something's stuck in our throat or, as you said, sinusitis. We might feel asthmatic. And that's the silent, what we call the silent reflux.
And one of the characteristics of silent reflux that makes it easier to diagnose is that, in fact, most of the time, people with silent refluxes have lots of symptoms. So if you list them all, hoarseness, cough, throat clearing, post-nasal drip, sinus congestion, ear popping, difficulty breathing, shortness of breath, on exertion, and even difficulty swallowing. And these symptoms, in varying degrees, people will notice, gee, sometimes the pill gets stuck and I have to wash it down. And so what makes the silent refluxer more obvious to those of us who see them is that they often have a little bit of four or five or six or all of those symptoms.
Right. Now, we watch television and see commercials on there from pharmaceutical companies, saying this, acid reflux is a big disease and here's some medication to take care of it. But you have a much better, I think, solution to that if we catch it early enough. And you talk about what we put into our bodies versus, what's refluxing. But let's first of all just talk about people who are on medication right now. Is it true that anybody could come off their medication if you know, assuming they don't have cancer at that point, but could anybody come off their medication at that point, follow your plan, and see benefits from it?
Well, let me begin by making a positive statement. The positive statement is reflux, including silent reflux. By the way, if you've got kids and you're giving, and they have asthma and you're giving them snacks before bed, stop. Particularly if you're giving them a treat, high-fat, chocolatey treat, ice cream and all that, stop giving them snacks. The kitchen should close early for kids. But the answer to the question, in my opinion, is not a very popular one, really, which is reflux is really a disease of what we eat and when we eat it. And it's just that simple. And so, you know, we think that obesity is associated with the reflux, with the obesity epidemic. The reflux epidemic and obesity are the same, but it's not true. Just for example, not long ago, I saw a man. He's a manager for a restaurant, and he gets off work at 11 o'clock, and by midnight, he's gone home, eaten a big dinner, and gone to bed. There's nothing I can do. There's no amount of purple pills or medication that'll solve this problem of this man who's now going to reflux all night long with the acid and enzymes basically self-digesting his esophagus and his throat. It's really about diet and lifestyle. And that what that means, of course, is that it's fixable.
And that's the good news. And you, this book, we should say, you talk about reflux, what it is. You talk about silent reflux, what that is. And you have some recipes in here, which look fantastic, by the way. I'm definitely going to try because I have this clearing the throat thing all the time. And I've been told I have asthmatic allergies. But after reading your book, I've made a connection between this and certain foods that I've been eating, which are on your bad list, if you want
well,
to say that.
Well, more than that, what I recommend for people who you're in the category of the likely, certainly possible, is to actually do a two-week detox or an induction diet. And it is strict. And this is what it means. The only is try to have no acid or little or no acid and low fat and no night eating. And so the induction diet, in 25 words or less, is only fruits, bananas, melons, a lot of poultry, fish, shellfish, vegetables, grains, but of the vegetables, no onions, garlic, tomatoes, and peppers. Nothing out of a bottle or a can except alkaline water. And close the kitchen at 8. 2 weeks, they'll clean it up for most people.
Why are so many doctors not familiar with this? Because you've been working on this for a long time, and you are a leading expert on this. Your opinion is sought, you know, many times over. Why are so many doctors not familiar with this?
Well, the problem is fragmentation between the specialties. I always jokingly say, do you know why we have specialties the way we have? I mean, if the reflux affects the sinuses and the nose and the throat and the ears and the esophagus and the lungs, why do we have four different specialists? And the answer is the specialties evolved so the doctors would be able to sort of divide up the pie without killing each other. But the reality is that the specialties are so fragmented that, if you will, no one sees the forest for the trees. So the gastroenterologists who think that they're reflux doctors don't even look at the throat. They don't even examine it at all. So how would they know? The otolaryngologists and ear, nose, and throat doctors, they don't have any test for reflux. And the lung doctors, they're not yet aware that reflux can cause problems with the lungs. So a lot of it has to do with fragmentation, if you will, academic turf in the medical profession. And it really, you know, the poor patients, particularly patients with chronic cough and asthma that isn't asthma, they go from doctor to doctor to doctor and rarely get a good answer.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier that esophageal cancer is the fastest growing cancer, and I saw a statistic that said it's jumped an astounding 500% in the last...
It's actually 800%.
800%. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, here's the bottom line on this. Reflux has increased from 10% of the population to 40% since the 70s, the last two generations. Cancer of the esophagus has increased 850%. And the truth be known, the biggest risk factor is the Food and Drug Administration in 1973 decided that we would put acid in everything to kill bacteria. And we believe that this profound acidification of all of our food is a major culprit. One statistic, in 2010, the average 12 to 29-year-old kid drank almost a half a gallon of soft drink a day, and they have the same acidity as the stomach acid.
Interesting. Now, I want to ask you this, because a couple of times I've talked with people over the years who've said sometimes we get heartburn and acid reflux because our stomach's not making enough acid, and simply eating a little more acid would solve the problem, but apparently not.
That's not true. And this whole idea that some people don't make enough acid, there's only one medical condition. It's a very specific one. And it's just, you know, it's an old wives' tale, whatever they say, that old idea that some people don't make enough acid.
Right, right.
If you, for example, have reflux and you take 19 pills a day, you're still going to make plenty of acid. The problem is the medicines for the people who need the big-time medicine don't work well enough. It's not that you produce no acid when you're on the medicine.
Mm.
So the idea of too low acid is really not true.
Right. So let's take a quick look at some notoriously bad reflux foods, and I'm sad to say that chocolate's at the top of
list. Well, you know, there are a whole bunch of things that are called trigger foods, and they're not the same for everybody. But the problem is that chocolate has caffeine, which helps relax the lower valve. It's relatively high fat that helps relax the lower valve. And it actually has a chemical in it, theobromine, which relaxes the valve. And for all the trigger foods there are, and onions are a trigger food. For some people, coffee is a trigger food, white wine, nuts. Anything can be a trigger food for someone. But unfortunately, chocolate's number one. When my reflux was bad, at its worst, I could behave myself for 2 weeks, eat one chocolate chip, and it was like putting an ignition cap to a stick of dynamite.
Hmm. Interesting. So we really
too
need...
Too bad, I know. I've sort of gotten off the chocolate over the years.
Well, you know, the other one that is right at the top there is something else I love, which is I love Perrier water. I love sparkling, and not the brand particularly, but the sparkling water is right at the top.
The problem is it's acidified. Mm. If you had it once in a while, that's fine. But the problem is that people like it, and then they have it. And what happens is the bubbles, you know, burst and the acid flows over your, and then it increases the pressure in the stomach and you have more reflux too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a major risk unless you're drinking small amounts. But when you compare it to all the sodas that are in bottles and cans, they're more acidic than stomach acid now. And that's why, in fact, I'll tell you a funny story. There was a person who claimed to have found a mouse in Diet Mountain Dew, and the defense was, that's not possible. If there was a mouse in a Mountain Dew, it would have dissolved.
Oh, my gosh.
That was the dissolving mouse defense.
Right, right. Let's look at some of the fruits, because apples, some of the apples are good for us as far as the pH balance goes. Some of them are not so good, like Granny Smith, Macintosh, but that's because they're more sour, right?
They are more acidic. Everything should be taken, you know, in relativity. If you are healthy and your reflux is under control, eating an acidic apple, the green ones are more acidic than the red ones, isn't going to kill you. On the other hand, I had a patient who had a Granny Smith apple before bed every night, and that's why she had reflux, because she was taking a big acid dose before bed. So what you eat and when you eat it, and you'll find that... generally speaking, people will figure out which foods cause the most problem for them. And apples, the really acidic apples, are not good for most people with reflux. That doesn't mean no one can ever have a Granny Smith apple again.
Right, right.
And generally, they're better cooked than they are raw and so on.
Yeah.
I think the thing that I need to mention to you, for your listeners, is to look for acid added. When you buy things that are in bottles and cans and it says ascorbic acid, citric acid, or vitamin C enhanced, those things are put in there as preservatives. But what that really means is they have the same acidity as stomach acid. They're not putting them in there just to get you a little extra vitamin. They're putting in it as a preservative.
Okay. Excellent. It's a really great book. And I know you are a pioneer in this field. And I appreciate you being with us today, Dr. Kaufman.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, really appreciate it.
And good luck. We'll talk again and see how you're doing after your two-week induction.
Yes, we will. And Dr. Kaufman's book is called Dropping Acid, The Reflux Diet Cookbook and Cure. It's a groundbreaking approach to healthy eating. And she's got 75 delicious original low-fat recipes in here, which truly do look delicious for anybody who likes to cook. And just before we go today, I want to say very quickly that there are over 70,000 people in the Northwest with Parkinson's disease. And there's a conference coming up, the 2012 HOPE Conference on Parkinson's. Just go to nwpf.org to find out more about that. I've been to a couple of their conferences, and they're very informative. As you know, my mother had Parkinson's. And that's coming up November 17th. So I'll remind you again before that date, but I just wanted to put that out there today. And you can find out more about Dr. Kaufman's book at refluxcookbook.com, refluxcookbook.com. All right, well, that's it for today. We'll be back next week. I thank you for being with us. You can reach me at 800-495-7617 or at info@conversationslive.net. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Thanks for being with us. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.